today, so every now and then, I'll get my notes together, and then somewhere around Friday or Saturday, this week it was Friday, I'll sit down and I'll write them, and then I'll let them sit for a little bit, because every now and then, so if you're ever involved in writing, you know that as you're writing, things can flow really great, and it feels so good, and it's so awesome. Then you leave it, and you come back, and you have no idea what you were even talking about, because everything is so all over the place. It's like your brain hiccuped between paragraphs, and you just started some new conversation, and that happens. And when I had finished my notes, I was like, I don't know how I feel about them. And so I brought my computer to Samantha's treatment on Friday, and I sat down, and I was like, just going to go back to the beginning. And before I realized it, I ended up rewriting the whole thing, which is super helpful, because at this point, I still don't know how I'm ending it. Just to be perfectly clear, this is going to exactly, yeah. We're going to be here forever. No, because eventually I'm going to get hungry. So this is going to end up wherever it ends up. And so we're just going to, I'm just going to let it go there. But we are in part 34 of our journey through Acts. We're in chapter 18. We should be done sometime in 2027. Everything will be fantastic and it'll be good. I can't wait till we get into Romans, because that I'm sure will last years. So it'll be fun, but I'm actually really enjoying what we're doing walking through the Bible. But, today we find ourselves in Acts chapter 18, verses 1 through 17. And, we find ourselves after Paul has left Athens. We don't know how long he was in Athens, but we know eventually he left and he went over to Corinth. And he's planting a church in a city that he will eventually become primarily known for. Paul's connection to Corinth and his work in Corinth has essentially been a big outline of his entire ministry. The books of 1 and 2 Corinthians are some of the most preached books in the New Testament. It's pretty amazing. And in this section, in verses 1 through 17, we don't find a ton out of the ordinary for Paul. Paul has a very predictable pattern when he gets into a new city, which usually ends in him in trouble, which is great. At least he knows what to expect. But God gives him a vision while he's in Corinth. And it prompts him to stay a little bit longer. And there's some very interesting things that happen in this process. And so what we're going to find a few interesting tidbits that I'm going to spend a little time talking about today. And they're going to come into play, not so much where we are right now, but as we start moving forward. And some things that I think may help us understand why Paul goes in certain directions in some of his writings, especially in his conversation about women. Some of the questions that I get in regard to Paul was, why did Paul hate women? And why was he so strict on women? Why did this happen? Why did that happen? And I think we're going to help answer some of that today, at least part of it. Okay, so let's start reading chapter 18, verses 1, and we're going to go through 11 first, and then we'll finish it up at the end. And it says, after these things, he departed Athens and went to Corinth. And he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, and his wife Priscilla, who recently came from Italy because Claudius had commanded that all the Jews depart from Rome. He came to them, and because he was of the same trade, they were all tent makers, he was staying with them, and they were working, for by trade they were tent makers. And he was reasoning in the synagogue every Sabbath and trying to persuade both Jew and Greek. But when Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia, Paul began devoting himself completely to the word, solemnly bearing witness to the Jews that Jesus is the Christ. But when they resisted and blasphemed, he shook out his garments and said to them, "Your blood be on your heads, I am clean. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." That's a pretty serious insult for a Jew, just so that you understand that. Then he left there and went to the house of a man named Titius Justus, a God-fearer whose house was right next door to the synagogue. I'm sure that went over really well. And Crispus, the leader of the synagogue, believed in the Lord with all of his household and many of the Corinthians. And when they heard, were believing and being baptized. And the Lord said to Paul in the night by a vision, do not be afraid, but go on speaking and do not be silent. For I am with you. Pay attention to this. No man will lay a hand on you in order to harm you. For I have many people in this city. And he stayed there a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. That's a long time. It's a long time for Paul to be in one place. And so we got this city. We got Corinth. So here's that journey. And remember, he went all the way down to Athens because he was running away from the Thessalonians and the Bereans because they wanted to really, really hurt him. Ends up in Athens, and then he shoots over to Corinth. Corinth is an amazing city. It was just an absolutely amazing city. These are some of the ruins of ancient Corinth. So if you look at that top one, you see how that kind of recessed little bottom part right there? That's what's referred to as a common bath. And it is as disgusting as you might think. It's like an unfiltered public pool. Yay, Band-Aid soup. It's amazing. This was Corinth. That little thing describes Corinth. Disgusting. Just, if you were to try to get your head wrapped around the type of city that Corinth was, you're going to put together three cities that we know of today. Washington, D.C., the Vatican, and Las Vegas. That was essentially Corinth. As corrupt, as twisted, and as morally depraved as you can imagine, Corinth was known throughout the Greek world as a bastion of immorality. But it was a port city, and it was a very important port city. There were two major ports there, the Centria and Lecheum. Now, the port of Corinth, the Centrian port, has since silted over, so it's not, after over the centuries, they didn't have the type of ability to remove sediment like we did, so the port just silted over, and business moved elsewhere. But while it was going on, Corinth was the place to be, because there was this little land bridge between Corinth and over the top, so the sailors that were coming around the coast could stop and drop all their stuff there, and it would work its way up to the big cities, versus going around through some very, very nasty straits that they would have to sail through, and no one likes doing that, especially during the harder times of the year for sailors. So what this did is it's made Corinth a magnet for businessmen, military deployments, and of course, every kind of temple worship your heart could desire. And temple worship had very predictable desires attached to it. When you put together deployed soldiers and a bunch of sailors who probably won't be home for years and years and years, you can understand where the desires went, okay? And it wasn't for intense prayer. And temple worship in Corinth was alive and well, okay? So what you would have in Corinth was what would be considered temple prostitutes, okay? But these temple prostitutes, this was not the type of immorality that we're talking about. This was not, and this can be a little hard to get our heads wrapped around of. We think prostitution is prostitution. That's not what this was. You had your red light districts, and that's what they were, but the bulk of the temple prostitution, the type of prostitution in Corinth was temple prostitution, and what it was a type of worship. So it was attached to your service to your god or your goddess. And so these temple prostitutes, they weren't just simply prostitutes, they were priestesses, believing that they were in service to their god or goddess or whoever they happened to be, whatever temple they happened to be in at the time. And these were women of significant influence. They tended to be teachers. They tended to do other things within the temple. They weren't just prostitutes, but that's how they made most of their money. Now, I'm not going to go into a bunch of detail, but it was way over the top. When you get into what went on in these temples, it's actually hard to imagine anyone being okay with that at any point in time. That's how over the top it was. I'm not going to describe it to you, but it's really disgusting. And what happened was, in this time, the city of Corinth got so known for its immorality that there was a slogan, a slang term called playing the Corinthian. It was an insult towards other women. If you were in another city and someone's like, oh yeah, yeah, playing the Corinthian, I see. What it meant was that you were throwing your body around, throwing your looks around, and acting like a tramp. It was not a good thing. It was a dig. You did not want to be looked at in that way. But that's how well Corinth was known for this activity. Now, we don't see a ton of the repercussions of this behavior playing out in Acts, but it does come into play in a lot of other areas in Paul's writings, primarily in two locations, his writings to the Corinthians and his writing to the church in Ephesus. Those are the two places where the temples more closely associated with this were established, and they were doing lots of business. And so these temples came with baggage. And I think this process, and the reason why I bring this up, is this process, I think, helps us understand Paul's strict directions to women in those two cities. It makes more sense to understand what Paul was trying to do. Paul is trying to establish a church in a place no one thought a church could ever be established. And Christians had to live there. Christian women had to live there. Christian men had to live there. And they had to be different from the people who were there. Now, during Paul's time ministering in both of these cities, the women who were serving as temple priestesses, remember, these were women who were not just simply prostitutes, they were priestesses, so they had influence, they were allowed to teach, they were allowed to instruct, but they were also doing whatever they wanted to and using their body and their looks to get their way. They knew how to manipulate people. That is not a habit that you just stop. You don't just turn that on and off like a light switch. When you have grown up in a Greek culture and you have been taught from early childhood that as a woman, if you were going to serve your God, you needed to learn how to access your femininity and leverage it for your benefit, you'd throw your looks around, you'd throw your influence around, you knew how to manipulate men to get what you want. Now all of a sudden, here comes this guy, he brings you this new faith, you come to Christ. Are you just going to stop doing that? Because every stitch of clothes that you own is designed to make you desirable to men. And now here are these same women who used to have authority and influence and money from one common practice now in the gospel preaching church. What do you do? I think Paul shows us what he was supposed to do. Paul knew that Christian women in Corinth and Ephesus had to be more dedicated than women in other areas. They had to be more vigilant and more careful of how they presented themselves, how they carried themselves, how they worked in the church. I think this was more important in those areas because you could set the church on a wrong path by making the church of Jesus Christ look like a temple full of prostitutes. So there are other standards that are involved. If you think about a woman of faith, of moral faith in a city of immoral filth, how much higher is the bar for her to walk by? What is the standard by which she must live her life? And I imagine a lot of these women probably thought to themselves, but these are the clothes that I have. You can't find other clothes anywhere else. This is the style. And all that other stuff, all those other excuses that we use today to justify doing whatever the heck we want. And we forget that there is a standard that God wants us to have. And the standard essentially comes down to this. A Christian woman should never be in a place where her dress, her attire, or her activity, or her language is going to confuse her with a prostitute. Whether a low-end prostitute or a high-end prostitute, it's irrelevant. God's standards for his women in his church are different. And part of the reason is because men are stupid. Okay? Maybe stupid's the wrong way. We are easily influenced. Okay? And most of us have spring-loaded necks that we don't even realize happens. You walk into a room and you see a guy go. There was no thought process in his brain that said, follow that. That did not happen. What happened is his brain automatically went and was like, and it took the Christian part of his brain to go, stop! You're going to get caught in a half a second. And he goes, and then we put sunglasses on so you can't track our eyes. Here is a reality in relationships that I wish, especially young men and young women would understand, that women, you will never be motivated in the same way a man is. And men, you will never be motivated in the same way a woman is. Men are visually motivated, period. Period. We can access our emotions later. But primarily, we are visually motivated. Women are primarily emotionally motivated. It is just the way God wired us. It is a natural thing. It doesn't mean that every man is a dog or a pig because his eyes went over to someone who was wearing a napkin and dental floss. It is as much, ladies, it is as much your fault as it is his if every guy in the room is like, because half of us are going, how did you get out of the house? And sometimes young girls get out of the house because mom thinks it was cute. I wish I could have wore that when I was a kid. Okay. I read a news story in the paper a little while ago. This is not a joke. 26-year-old grandmother. Do the math. Grandmother. She was so proud. No. We have to be different. We have to think different. And we have to intentionally portray ourselves differently. Now you notice, ladies, I didn't tell you at all what to wear, what not to wear. I simply let you know that God's watching, and so is everybody else, okay? If you're going to step out of the house going, I look good, then don't get mad when everyone is staring at you. Pig, you did it on purpose. Never allow yourself, ladies, never allow yourself to be mixed up with someone who's for sale. You should never look like you come with a price tag. You're more valuable than that. Paul knows this. But unfortunately, Paul is dealing with women who were for sale and did live like that. And now he's establishing a church, and a lot of those women are there. And you know what they want to do? They want to dress the same. They want to have the same amount of influence. They want to be able to teach and instruct men. They want the same authority and power and influence that they had in the temples, in the church. No. No. Doesn't work that way. So now, while all scholars do not agree, this is kind of a split issue. I think Paul's directions to women help us understand two things. One, why Paul would put such limitations, very strict limitations, on women in Corinth and Ephesus, but then leave those same instructions out of all of his other letters to the other churches. It's only in two places, folks. What you hear most often from Paul is instructions within marriage. That's not the same thing. But in Corinth and Ephesus, he put instructions on marriage and the church. It helps us understand why he would possibly have done that. And secondly, a question that comes up very often is, why would Paul seem to contradict himself by keeping women under such strict rules in some places, but allowing some women to be part of his ministry team? How does that work? How does that balance? Why could Paul one say women should never teach or have any authority over man? They should need to sit quietly in the church. But at the same time, if you go to the end of Romans, the last chapter of Romans, 28 people are thanked by Paul for being part of those who have ministered with him. One even spent time in jail with him for her proclamation of the gospel work. One of them, Junia, is listed among the apostles as either someone who was an apostle or someone who was recognized by the apostles as a teacher and preacher of the word. Out of those 28 people, 10 were women. This seems like you got two different Pauls. Unless we understand something about Paul. Where Paul understood where morality is for sale, Christian morality has to go up. It has to be under tighter control. We have to be more careful with what we're doing. It makes a lot of sense when you look at Paul in that way. When Paul's trying to tell us that when you're in the midst of this, you need to be more careful. But at the same time, he's not contradicting himself, because God used women all through the Old Testament. So we have to be very careful with the standards that we apply to the church of all time. So when you're doing your study, when you're reading the Bible for yourself, you got to ask yourself, was Paul talking to the entire church for all time, or to a specific problem in specific churches? Now, you decide for yourself, because I don't think it's a sin either way. But I think when it comes down to culture, when it comes down to society, whenever I see a rule that exists within the church, especially in Scripture, and then I see God violate that rule, what I know is that that rule is cultural, not spiritual. And so we have to look at that. So when you see God violating something that we think is an ironclad rule, what we know is it's not that ironclad, is it? That it's actually more social. And as society changes, we should try our best to try to adapt to it. Now, does that mean women should rule the world? No. Because the church is set up the same way as a family. And in a family, God has determined something very clearly. That is, the family is to be led by the husband. That's the way he set it up. Does that mean that mom has no say in the family? Only if dad is dumb. But at the end of the day, dad's got to stand before God and give an account for what happens under his roof. Go back to Genesis. It's part of the judgment. That's why as teachers and preachers, we're told that we are judged more heavily. Because we're responsible for what we teach. And we're responsible for what we are allowing to be taught. So we got to be more careful with that. So, simple breakdown. Ladies, don't dress like a prostitute. Guys, don't let your wives or your daughters dress like prostitutes. And don't look at prostitutes. How about that one? See how easy that was? Really simple. So secondly, we got Paul meeting some new people. We got Aquila and Priscilla. Paul meets them because Emperor Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome. This is where they lived, and church tradition tells us that they lived there because Priscilla's family was rich. She had land, she had property, so he married up. Good for him. But then they get kicked out of Rome because they were following Judaism. Like Paul, they make their living making tents, which was far more lucrative than you think. We're not talking about little pup tents. We're talking about big leather hand-stitched tents. These things, they took a long time to make, and they were very, very valuable. So we don't learn a ton about Priscilla and Aquila here in this chapter. We just kind of get introduced to them. But what you're going to find is as we move on, they become very important to Paul's ministry, especially Priscilla. She does something really amazing coming down the road. And then at some point, Silas and Timothy show up, possibly by boat, after their work in Thessalonica was finished. And it was assumed that Paul received an offering from the Thessalonican church because he was there making tents for a little while with them. And then after Timothy and Silas show up, he could dedicate himself fully to the Lord. So the thought is that Paul received an offering from the church that freed him up from having to try to make a living so that he could just dedicate himself daily to the expression of the gospel. And he did just that. And for the next 18 months, he spent the entire time preaching and teaching and getting into trouble, because that's what Paul did. And that's why we love him. So Paul began to work in the synagogue, but something is different. He has been all over the Mediterranean. He has gotten into trouble time and time again. We're a couple of years into his journey here at this point, and he gets to Corinth, and something is different here. And what's different here is that the Jews are falling out of what little favor they had with Rome. Things are starting to go downhill for the Jewish nation. And this starts to work well for Paul. Emperor Claudius, remember, was expelling Jews from Rome. So whatever little favor they had was falling off, which meant all the Roman rulers from around the area didn't have to tolerate them anymore, didn't have to put up with them anymore. And another thing to take into consideration, that this is around AD 53 or 54. So this is less than 20 years. So you're talking 15 to 16 years away from what would become the siege of Jerusalem that would take Jerusalem down to its foundation. So it's around this time that the Jews in Jerusalem begin causing problems for Rome regularly that involves Rome sending more troops down there and people dying. You have these little battles going on all over the place. Rome didn't like this very much. You had at that time what was called the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome. The Peace of Rome came at the end of a spear. They didn't like, if you caused problems, they didn't want to deal with you or reason with you. They just went in and killed you because it was easier. But the Jews are constantly having these little uprisings because people in Jerusalem were coming up saying, I'm the Messiah, I'm the promised one, I will lead you to defeat our oppressors, Rome, and we will establish God's kingdom on this earth. Because that's, remember, that's what the Jews believed was the promise of God, that they would be rulers on the earth. And so all these guys, they're like two or three of them over the course of the next 10 or 12 years started coming up saying, follow me, I'm the Messiah, which I think is very interesting because Jesus warned us about this in Matthew 24 when he was talking to the disciples, and Jesus answered, said, see to it that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And you remember at the end of this, he said, this is going to happen within a generation. Generation was 40 years. This was around AD 30. Destruction of temple was around AD 70. We're right on schedule. So this started causing serious trouble for Jews around the Roman world. And what made it even better is that the local Jews in Corinth, especially Corinth and Athens, they were saying, do not associate these followers of the way with us. They are not the same. They are not us. Paul couldn't have scripted that better, because Rome needed someone to hate. And at the time, it wasn't Christianity. At the time, they were turning their attention to the Jews. And so when the Christians, they tried to get the Christians in trouble, Rome didn't care. They didn't want anything to do with it. You know, I don't really care. Our issue is with you. You deal with it yourself. And this allowed Christianity to be separated from Judaism. And in some places, it allowed Christianity to grow a little unhindered. It's not a bad thing. So you got all these things going on that were working in Paul's favor in Corinth. And the reason I named this message Patience and Strength is because I think Paul demonstrates both in ways that we should try to emulate. that we should be adding to our faith. We should be trying to live in this same way. Paul had a ton of success in Corinth converting the synagogue leader. That's not a small thing. And after he got kicked out of the synagogue, Crispus, which is a really funny name, by the way. It sounds like a Middle Eastern potato chip, doesn't it? It's just like, it would be great. And you'll get that on the way home. So when Paul gets kicked out of the synagogue, Crispus has to either recant or leave his job. He leaves his job. He loses all of his salary, all of his benefits, all of his influence to follow Paul and this Christ. And they open up a church right next to the synagogue. It's made it very easy for them to keep ministering to both Jews and Greeks. Because if you were a Jew going to the temple, you could just easily sneak off and listen to Paul and you wouldn't get in trouble for it. So while in Corinth, Paul received something from God that he had not received before. He received a vision and a promise of protection and encouragement for him to speak boldly. And I think that's very interesting because he's in one of the worst cities in the Greek world at the time, morally speaking. And God is saying, I want you to stay there and I want you to keep speaking. Keep speaking boldly. Don't stop. No one's going to lay a hand on you. And so for 18 months, he's building this church. 18 months. The last time he had spent that much time there was Antioch. Antioch became a hub of missionary activity for the Greek world. Now here he is in Corinth building a church in the middle of a moral cesspool. I think part of that is that God knew, and Paul could not have foreseen, how vital Paul's correspondence back and forth with the church was going to be for the church centuries later. I think God could see that. Paul is just being obedient at the time. And it makes me think of the amazing patience that Paul had for his work. And in my mind, I started to contrast that with the amazing amount of impatience we have in the church today for work, to make things happen. We tend to want things right now. We want to get, let's just get it done. Let's just do this. Let's buy it. Let's buy it already made instead of let's put this thing together. Let's work together and let's build this. We tend to want things right now. Kids today want things right now. Do you remember when, I don't know how many of you, you know, I'm 51, so I've been around for a little while, and like when Nintendo first came out, you'd get a game. There was no cheat codes. Eventually those started coming out, but you would spend weeks in front of your TV trying to figure out which way to turn and where the secret jewel is and how to do this. And you'd spend all this time working on this. And then your friend whose parents had a little bit of money would buy the magazine and be like, oh, I got the, you know, ultimate life cheat code and I know where everything is. And they just like through the game, spend $80 on a game and you're done with it in 15 minutes because that was awesome. All they wanted was the joy of beating the game. See, there was no joy in the journey. There was no joy in discovery. There was no joy in learning. There was no joy in developing. The joy was in the end result, period. And a lot of kids today are taught that. Seek the end. And get it at any cost. I think in the church we need to do it a little differently. I think we need to have more patience for what we're doing today and have a long vision. I want to have a ministry resource training center here at the church. That's my goal. Now here's what can happen. I can get online and I can get a hold of curriculum. There's other churches in the area that do it. And just start a school. That's great. That's awesome. No space for it. We don't have people trained in the teaching. And I don't have students lined up at this point. So what do we do? Like, you know, eventually it'll happen. No. When I talk to people about it, and like, oh, wow, when do you think that'll happen? I said, I don't know, probably somewhere between 5 and 10 years. I think that'll happen. Like, I'm sorry. What? Yeah, somewhere about 5 and 10 years. I'd love to have it up and running before I retire. What? You mean you like don't want it tomorrow? No, I don't want what I can buy tomorrow. I want what we can build that's going to last forever. That's what I want. That's how I want it set up. That means slow, gradual process. Continued moving forward. Little steps, little steps. That way when it's built, it's strong. It can't just be knocked off. It takes time. It takes patience. We learn that from people like Paul. Paul's patience is something we should all strive for. How many of you would sit down every day, 6 to 7 days a week for 18 months, teaching someone how to understand the Bible and not miss a day? A lot of times we would think after a couple of weeks, like, gosh, haven't you got this yet? No. God benched Paul for 12 years before he said, and this was after Paul was a Pharisee, 12 years before he set him free, of Paul learning how to understand and apply the Bible before he was ready for the mission field. We don't get ready in 6 months. We don't get ready in a year. It's a lifestyle. It takes a long time. Patience is a fruit of the Spirit, and we should all strive to cultivate that in our lives. On the other side, you have Paul's strength, and I love this. I'm not talking about the kind of strength that can lift heavy things. I'm talking about the kind of strength that allows you to walk away from someone you want to throat punch. The kind of strength that allows you to be belittled and be okay with it. The kind of strength that gives you internal authority and power because you're not worried about what's going on around you. Because you're trusting in the one who sent you. That's strength. Paul is not only our example of what it means to serve with patience, he's also our example of what it means to serve in strength. Because that is the kind of strength that only comes from God. Only the strength that comes from God is going to allow you to go from city to city to city, paying your own way, getting work as you're going, and being beaten up, thrown in jail, whipped, stripped, driven out of the city, and you just start over in the next one. That is the strength of God. And that requires something very different. That's a very different mentality. That's a very different attitude. When Paul says, it doesn't matter if they receive it or not, if they drive me out or not, God has called me to bring it, and that's all I need to focus on. And that's what he does. And he's here in Corinth for 18 months. No one is able to lay a hand on him. That's so different for him. Usually by this time, he's either been beaten, jailed, or both, and off to a new city. So 18 months later, we see this in verse 12. We'll be wrapping up here in a second. It says, but while Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, he was the Greek ruler, the Roman ruler at that time, the Jews with one accord rose up against Paul. Uh-oh, is God breaking his word? Nope. He rose up against Paul and brought him before the judgment seat, and I love this, saying, this man persuades men to worship God contrary to the law. What that means, you go all the way back to Thessalonica, go all the way back to Jerusalem with Jesus. What they're saying to the ruler of Rome is he is claiming that there's a God other than Caesar, and he needs to be put in jail for that. What they're saying is we have no God but Caesar. Going all the way back to the same thing they used for Jesus. This guy is spreading a different religion, and he needs to be dealt with. And I love this next part. But when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio says to the Jews, if it were a wrongdoing or a vicious crime, O Jews, it would be reasonable for me to put up with you. But if there's a question about words and names and your own law, see to it yourselves. I am not willing to be a judge of these matters. And he drove them away from the judgment seat. And the part that I think is unfortunately funny, and they took hold of Sosthenes, the leader of the synagogue, the guy who replaced Crispus, and began beating him in front of the judgment seat. But Gallio was not concerned about any of these things. Yikes! So Sosthenes is the guy who would have stirred up the crowd. He would have gotten everyone involved. We're going to deal with this Paul. We're going to take him. We're going to exercise our favor with the Roman rulers, and we're going to get this guy dealt with. We've had enough of him. And the crowd gets all worked up. Yeah, crowds at this time loved a good beating. It was kind of like their version of NASCAR. You don't go to watch the track. Everyone knows. You go to watch the wrecks. That's, everyone understands this. And so they're going, and they're just wanting to get, they just want to see someone get in trouble because they love this. And they get there, and Gallio says to them, basically, I don't care. And that tells you how much favor the Jews had lost in that time frame. Claudius was kicking them out. No one cared what was going on. But here's the other side of that. They didn't have the authority to do anything on their own. They were away from Jerusalem. They had no prison. They didn't have any guards. They had the few people that they had there and whatever money they had. They didn't have the resources to do anything, which is why they were going to the proconsul. So when the proconsul basically said, I don't care, they knew they were done. Everything was over. Paul walks, but the crowd is worked up. The crowd wants to see a beating, and the crowd gets what they want. So Sosthenes, say that 10 times really fast, finds himself receiving the very beating he was hoping to get for Paul. You think about this, patience and strength. Paul receives a vision from God, and here he is standing before another ruler, probably thinking he's about to get the same thing that he's gotten before, and as he's trying to speak, God's promise literally, basically is shown right in front of him. Almost like saying, I told you, no one would harm you. Now watch this. Now, part of me wonders if Gallio was walking away thinking, as he's looking at Sosthenes getting beaten to a pulp, going, well, that didn't go as planned, now did it? Do you think that gave Paul strength? You think he stood a little taller as he was walking away? Now, history says Paul was maybe about an inch taller than me, so he wasn't standing that tall. But I bet he walked away thinking, yeah, God's in this. We got it. And before he left, he established a thriving church, a church that thrived there for many, many decades in one of the worst cities in the world. And God protected him the whole time he was there. That's amazing. It makes me realize that when we stay focused, when we stay focused on the gospel, when we stay focused on mission, God is with us. Remember, I've said this multiple times throughout this series. When the gospel is our focus, the Holy Spirit shows up. When other things are our focus, we're on our own because we're not doing what God has asked us to do. The gospel is our focus. It is our only focus. It is the primary reason we do everything that we do. If the gospel is not involved in it, then I got to question whether or not we should be doing it. Even if it's just being an example to the people around us. Helping Hands is a great example of that. We go. Jay won't take anything from anybody. People constantly say, oh, wait, let me pay it. No. Can I give you guys lemonade? Yes. Hamburgers and hot dogs? Naturally. And if I'm not mistaken, Jay, correct me if I'm wrong, people have asked you why you do this, and it's just because it's the right thing to do. This is what God has asked us to do. We just want to help you. Patience and strength. Being who God has told us to be, representing the gospel in a powerful, undeniable way to a world that doesn't usually believe half of what we try to bring to them because we need to live it. So as we're being these examples, as we're taking this message out into the world, let's make sure we do a few things. Let's make sure, one, we don't look like people we don't want to be looking like and acting like people we don't want to be confused with. And let's make sure we do it with patience to be there through the whole thing. Don't start it if you're not going to finish it. Patience and strength. Even in the days of failure, even in the days that are difficult, we stand up and we trust that God will be there because he sent us. We just trust him. Make sense?